Principle 4.1. Understand the power that comes from knowing how you and others are wired. As I related in the first part of the book, my first breakthrough in understanding how people are wired differently occurred when I was a young father and had my kids tested by Dr. Sue Quinlan. I found the results remarkable because she not only confirmed my own observations of the ways their minds were working at the time, but also predicted how they would develop in the future. For example, one of my kids was struggling with arithmetic. Because he tested well in mathematical reasoning, she correctly told him that if he pushed through the boredom of rote memorization required in elementary school, he would love the higher level concepts he would be exposed to when he got older. These insights opened my eyes to new possibilities. I turned to her and others years later when I was trying to figure out the different thinking styles of my employees and colleagues. At first, the experts gave me both bad and good advice. Many seemed as if they were more interested in making people feel good, or at least not feel bad, than they were in getting at the truth. Even more startling, I found that most psychologists didn't know much about neuroscience, and most neuroscientists didn't know much about psychology, and both were reluctant to connect the physiological differences in people's brains to the differences in their aptitudes and behaviors. But eventually I found Dr. Bob Eichinger, who opened the world of psychometric testing to me. Using Myers-Briggs and other assessments, we evolved a much clearer and more data-driven way of understanding our different types of thinking. Our differences weren't a product of poor communication. It was the other way around. Our different ways of thinking led to our poor communications. From conversations with experts and my own observations, I learned that our mental differences are physiological. Just as our physical attributes determine the limits of what we're able to do physically, our brains are innately different in ways that set the parameters of what we're able to do mentally. As with our bodies, some parts of our brains cannot be materially affected by our external experiences, in the same way that your skeleton isn't changed much through working out, while other parts of our brains can be strengthened through exercise, which we call brain plasticity and we'll talk about later. This was driven home to me in a very personal way by my son's 3-year struggle with bipolar disorder. As terrifying and frustrating as his behavior was, I came to realize that it was due to his brain's chemistry, specifically its secreting serotonin and dopamine in spurts and sputters. As I went through that terrible journey with him, I experienced the frustration and anger of trying to reason with someone who wasn't thinking well. I constantly had to remind myself that there was no basis for my anger because his distorted logic was a product of his physiology. I saw for myself how the doctors who approached it that way brought him to a state of crystal clarity. The experience not only taught me a lot about how brains work, but why creative genius often exists at the edge of insanity. Many highly productive and creative people have suffered from bipolar disorder, among them Ernest Hemingway, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Vincent van Gogh, Jackson Pollock, Virginia Woolf, Winston Churchill, and the psychologist K. Redfield Jameson, who has written frankly about her own experiences with the disease in her book, An Unquiet Mind. I learned that we are all different because of the different ways that the machine that is our brain works, and that nearly 1 in 5 Americans are clinically mentally ill in one way or another. Once I understood that it's all physiological, many things became clearer to me. While I used to get angry and frustrated at people because of the choices they made, I came to realize that they weren't intentionally acting in a way that seemed counterproductive. They were just living out things as they saw them based on how their brains worked. I also realized that as off-base as they seemed to me, they saw me the same way. The only sensible way for us to behave with each other was to look down on ourselves with mutual understanding so we could make objective sense of things. Not only did this make our disagreements less frustrating, it also allowed us to maximize our effectiveness. Everyone is like a Lego set of attributes, with each piece reflecting the workings of a different part of our brains. All these pieces come together to determine what each person is like, and if you know what a person is like, you'll have a pretty good idea of what you can expect from them. Now I'm going to turn it over to Jeremy Bob to go over the rest of the principles in this chapter.
A. We are born with attributes that can both help us and hurt us, depending on their application. Most attributes are a double-edged sword that bring potential benefits and potential harm. The more extreme the attribute, the more extreme the potential good or bad outcomes it is likely to produce. For example, a highly creative, goal-oriented person good at imagining new ideas might undervalue the minutiae of daily life, which is also important. He might be so driven in his pursuit of long-term goals that he might have disdain for people who focus on the details of daily life. Similarly, a task-oriented person who is great with details might undervalue creativity, and worse still, may squelch it in the interests of efficiency. These two people might make a great team, but are likely to have trouble taking advantage of the ways they're complementary, because the ways their minds work make it difficult for them to see the value of each other's ways of thinking. Having expectations for people, including yourself, without knowing what they are like, is a sure way to get in trouble. I learned this the hard way, through years of frustrating conversations and the pain of expecting things from people who were constitutionally incapable of delivering them. I'm sure that I caused them plenty of pain, too. Over time, I realized that I needed a systematic approach to capturing and recording our differences so that we could actively take them into consideration when putting people into different roles at Bridgewater. This led to one of my most valuable management tools, baseball cards, which I mention in the first part of this book. Just as a baseball card compiles the relevant data on a baseball player, helping fans to know what that player is good and bad at, I decided that it would be similarly helpful for us to have cards for all of our players at Bridgewater. In creating the attributes for our baseball cards, I used a combination of adjectives we already use to describe people, like conceptual, reliable, creative, and determined. The actions people took or didn't take, such as holding others accountable and pushing through to results, and terms from personality tests, such as extroverted or judging. Once the cards were established, I created a process to have people evaluate each other, with the people rated highest in each dimension, for example, most creative, having more weight on the ratings of other people in that dimension. People with proven track records in a certain area would get more believability or decision-making weight within that area. By recording these qualities in people's baseball cards, others who'd never worked with them before could know what to expect from them. When people changed, their rating would change. And when they didn't change, we were even more sure of what we could expect of them. Naturally, when I introduced this tool, people were skeptical or scared of it for various reasons. Some were afraid that the cards would be inaccurate. Others thought it would be uncomfortable to have their weaknesses made so apparent or that it would lead to their being pigeonholed, inhibiting their growth. Still others thought it would be too complex to be practical. Imagine how you would feel if you were asked to force rank all your colleagues on creativity, determination, or reliability. Most people at first find that prospect frightening. Still, I knew that we needed to be radically open in recording and considering what people were like, and that things would eventually evolve to address people's concerns if we were sensible about how we approach the process. Today, most everyone at Bridgewater finds these baseball cards to be essential, and we have built a whole suite of other tools, which will be further described in work principles, to support our drive to understand what people are like and who is believable at what. I've already noted that our unique way of operating and the treasure trove of data we accumulated brought us to the attention of some world-renowned organizational psychologists and researchers, Bob Keegan of Harvard University, Adam Grant of the Wharton School, and Ed Hess of the University of Virginia, have written about us extensively, and I have learned a great deal from them in turn. In a way I never intended, our trial and error discovery process has put us at the cutting edge of academic thinking about personal development within organizations. As Keegan wrote in his book, An Everyone Culture, from the individual experience of probing in every one-on-one meeting to the technologically integrated processes for discussing issues and baseball cards to the company-wide practices of daily updates and cases, Bridgewater has built an ecosystem to support personal development. The system helps everyone in the company confront the truth about what everyone is like. Our journey of discovery has coincided with an incredibly fertile epoch in neuroscience when, thanks to rapid advances in brain imaging and the ability to gather and process big data, our understanding has accelerated dramatically. As with all sciences on the cusp of breakthroughs, I am sure that much of what is thought to be true today will soon be radically improved, but what I do know is how incredibly beautiful and useful it is to understand how the thinking machine between our ears works. Here's some of what I've learned. The brain is even more complex than we can imagine. It has an estimated 89 billion tiny computers called neurons that are connected to each other through many trillions of wires called axons and chemical synapses. As David Eagleman describes in his wonderful book, Incognito, your brain is built of cells called neurons and glia, hundreds of billions of them. Each one of them is as complex as a city. The cells, neurons, are connected in a network of such staggering complexity that it bankrupts human language and necessitates new strains of mathematics. A typical neuron makes about 10,000 connections to neighboring neurons. Given billions of neurons, this means that there are as many connections in a single cubic centimeter of brain tissue as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. When we are born, our brains are pre-programmed with learning accumulated over hundreds of millions of years. For example, researchers at the University of Virginia have shown that while many people have an instinctual fear of snakes, no one has an instinctual fear of flowers. The brains that we were born with had learned that snakes are dangerous and flowers are not. And there's a reason for that. There is one grand design for the brains of all mammals, fish, birds, amphibians, and reptiles, which was established nearly 300 million years ago and has been evolving ever since. Just as cars have evolved into different versions, sedans, SUVs, sports cars, etc., that rely on many of the same underlying parts, all vertebrate brains have similar parts that do similar things, but that are well adapted to the needs of their own particular species. For example, birds have superior optical lobes because they need to spot prey and predators from great heights. While we humans think of ourselves as superior overall because we overemphasize the importance of our own advantages, other species could justifiably make the same claims on their own behalf. Birds for flight, eyesight, and instinctual magnetic navigation, most animals for smell, and several for appearing to have particularly enjoyable sex. This universal brain has evolved from the bottom up, meaning that its lower parts are evolutionarily the oldest and the top parts are the newest. The brainstem controls the subconscious processes that keep us and other species alive: heartbeat, breathing, nervous system, and our degree of arousal and alertness. The next layer up, the cerebellum, gives us the ability to control our limb movements by coordinating sensory input with our muscles. Then comes the cerebrum, which includes the basal ganglia, which controls habit, and other parts of the limbic system, which controls emotional responses and some movement, and the cerebral cortex, which is where our memories, thoughts, and sense of consciousness reside. The newest and most advanced part of the cortex, that wrinkled mass of gray matter that looks like a bunch of intestines, is called the neocortex, which is where learning, planning, imagination, and other higher-level thoughts come from. It accounts for a significantly higher ratio of the brain's gray matter than is found in the brains of other species.